together.
From WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida, I'm Al Ledson, and you are listening to State of the Reunion. Right now, I am standing on a beach in Hawaii, on the island of Kauai, and it is everything you dream of. I mean, just close your eyes and imagine the beautiful sand, the surf coming in, you can see the waves out in the distance, palm trees behind you. It really is a tropical paradise here. I could spend the entire show making you jealous, talking about how beautiful it is. Seriously, call me. I'll brag some more. I've got plenty of pictures to prove it. But no matter where you go, no matter how beautiful or ordinary it may seem, there is always something under the surface, hidden from view. A foundation upon which the present stands. And here in Hawaii, that foundation is built in part with sugar. Yep, sugar. The stuff you poured into your coffee and cereal this morning. The same way cotton transformed life in the South, sugar reshaped society in Hawaii over a century ago, uprooting the natural order of these islands and leaving behind a legacy of discontent and outrage.
Once they discovered that it was a perfect place to grow sugar, because the soil was rich, there was lots of rain, and it was hot.
The plantation era kind of marks a point in our history where power and struggle over land and water took an entirely different turn. The repercussions that the production of sugar had, that's something that we still haven't recovered from today.
To start, Hawaii might not even be a part of the U.S. if it weren't for sugar. In fact, some people question whether Hawaii is a part of the U.S.
No, this government was hijacked in 1893, period.
This is Keanu Sai. Now, if you think that first name sounds a little familiar, it is.
So if you notice Keanu, my name, Keanu Reeves, the movie actor, okay, that's actually a cousin. So his dad is from this same valley.
Keanu grew up in Hawaii, and what he learned about the island's history in school was a very particular narrative.
We were taught, missionaries came, we prayed to God, our lands were stolen, and now we're a state. A very simple history.
And as Keanu got older, he didn't question this history. He ended up joining the U.S. military. And one day, when he was at a military academy on the mainland,
I get a call from my mom. And my mom says that my grandmother, my tutu, in Hawaiian we say tutu, she had cancer and she went into hospice. And she told my mom to let me know that she won't pass away until I come home.
So Keanu goes home to visit his tutu. And she tells him all kinds of stories he'd never heard before.
And then she says, Keanu, promise me one thing. She said, promise me that you will know your genealogy. Because when you know your genealogy, you will know who you are and what you need to do.
He goes back to his regular life, continues his military career, serves in the Hawaii Army National Guard. But eventually, he starts the research commanded by his tutu, finding his family line going back to the 1300s. And as he started looking at all these primary source documents,
I began to realize things that I didn't know before. I began to realize that what I was taught in the schools was wrong.
What Keanu found out would completely change his idea, not only of where he's from, but who he is. Now, here's where we need to detour into Hawaiian history. We'll come back to Keanu in a bit. I should say, if you've never heard this history before, don't be embarrassed. I didn't know it either. But sugar plays a huge role in all of it.
The beginning of the sugar industry really is a missionary initiative.
That's John Osorio. Actually, the longer version is...
So my name is Jonathan K. Kamakaviva Ole Osorio.
Which I knew I would mispronounce if I tried to say it. John is a native Hawaiian and professor of Hawaiian studies at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. By the time those missionaries showed up, Hawaiians had lived here for more than 1,500 years. They were self-sufficient, sustained by fishing and growing taro, a plant that they thought of as a brother. The islands were ruled by chiefs and then a king.
There were very centralized systems of authority.
But then the Western sailors came, and with them a bounty of disease. syphilis, gonorrhea, cholera, typhoid, smallpox, measles, the ugly gifts of foreigners.
And then you have this 40-year great dying that takes place, and you're looking at a depopulation of at least 50% in that 40 years, and possibly closer to 75.
Death hung in the fields and on the beaches. The smooth cycles of Hawaiian society were disrupted, and this is when the missionaries arrive and find a place vastly different from what the first sailors found. All the missionaries see is chaos, chaos that they know how to fix. The savages need to be civilized, and so the missionaries teach the natives to read, to dress, and eventually to farm sugar.
The justification for this was this: you have all of this wasted land, and in fact, there was. I mean, places that had been cultivated in taro were now not being cultivated in taro, not because people were not interested in growing taro, but because families had been halved or basically destroyed by these diseases.
The world had a hunger for sugar sweetness, and Hawaii had land and labor to offer. But growing sugar meant gaining control of that land. So, in addition to preaching about the Bible, the missionaries started preaching the righteousness of land ownership. See, until this point, all the land in Hawaii had been shared.
So there really is no property that exists in Hawaii. But in the 1830s, a growing number of merchants are clamoring for the ability to purchase property.
Eventually, the king agrees to divide up the land. Ordinary people can get their share, but first, they need to petition the land commission to get a deed. And the Haoles, the Hawaiian word for foreigners, they're much better at that.
Once private property was established, within really just a couple of decades, something like 68% of the private property was actually owned by Haole corporations or individuals.
The sugar plantations boom. The Civil War breaks out in America, which, among other things, means that Northerners can no longer buy their sugar from where they've been getting it, the South. So they turn to Hawaii. Then, after the war ends, the sugar barons, they don't want to let go of this new American market, but they can't compete because of the U.S. tariff on Hawaiian sugar. They want to get rid of it. But what would the U.S. get in trade?
And there wasn't anything that we could really offer the United States until the Americans discovered Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor changes everything. It's the perfect spot to give America a strategic base in the Pacific. A treaty is eventually signed, no sugar tariffs, in exchange for a lease of Pearl Harbor. And sugar profits rise 1,000% in two decades. But the king keeps making noise about scrapping the treaty, and the now wealthy businessmen don't like that idea.
And when the king holds firm, they come to the palace armed. They've got armed men in the streets. They say, you know, here's a new constitution we want you to sign. This is in 1887. This constitution basically removes all of your executive power. From now on, you do what the cabinet decides. And here's a list of cabinet members.
Hawaiians are furious to see their king stripped of his power. And when the king's sister succeeds him to become the queen, she tries to heed the call of her people and drafts a new constitution. But the businessmen have other ideas. And as one of their political allies put it,
you know, Hawaii is a pear ripe for the plucking. It is time for us to pick it.
And pick it they do. It's January 16, 1893. The sugar businessmen take up arms and seize the building of the Hawaiian government. They get the American diplomat to Hawaii to order the U.S. Marines to land on Hawaiian soil to protect the businessmen. The sugar businessmen proclaim themselves the new Hawaiian government. The queen can't arrest the conspirators for fear that the American troops will interfere and start an all-out war. So she bows to the superior military power of the U.S.
You could read the text of her words, and she's really, really clear. She's not surrendering to the provisional government. She doesn't acknowledge them.
But for the sugar businessmen, that's not enough. They want Hawaii to be annexed by the U.S., but the U.S. Congress can't seem to pass a treaty of annexation. Hawaiians sign petitions in the tens of thousands, begging America to restore their queen or let them remain independent.
So Francis Newlands from Nevada, he's a representative. What he does is he submits a joint resolution of annexation to the Congress, to the House, and then to the Senate to annex Hawaii. Now we have a problem here.
Here's Keanu Sai again with the information he stumbled on while researching his genealogy. This is what blew Keanu's mind.
A Joint resolution is a congressional law. Congressional laws have no effect on the borders of the United States. The United States could no more annex a foreign country called Hawaii by passing a joint resolution than the United States can pass a joint resolution today annexing Canada. You need a treaty.
I mean, it's just like saying, so in Congress, like, all right, so we're just going to take over Mexico because it's really bad. So
that's called occupation. It's another word for trespassing. That did not make Hawaii a part of the United States.
The more Keanu dug around in the documents, the more evidence he found. Hawaii had never been a colony of the U.S. It had been its own fully fledged nation, recognized around the world.
By 1893, Hawaii had over 90 embassies and consulates all over the world. In fact, Hawaii had an embassy in Washington, D.C., and the United States had an embassy in Honolulu. I didn't know any of this stuff.
Now, when he discovered all this, Keanu was still serving in the U.S. military, and that presented some problems.
When I then began to realize I was in the wrong army, I began to realize Hawaii's occupied. That's a heavy, heavy statement right there. I remember telling my sergeant, I said, hey, Sarge, you're not going to believe what I'm uncovering back home. I don't know if I'm an American.
Keanu, being Keanu, thinks about this in terms of the Matrix.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland.
Remember how the main character, Neo, is awakened by Morpheus to discover the real world? And that what he thought was reality was, in fact, the Matrix? This Keanu sees Hawaii being a part of the U.S., as his Matrix.
What I went through was what people saw in Matrix 1. Morpheus, are you going to take the red pill, blue pill?
You should take the blue pill, man.
But Keanu Sai, just like Keanu Reeves, decides to take the red pill. The question was, what do you do now? Keanu retired from the army, went back to school, got his PhD in political science. His dissertation focused on how to move forward with Hawaii as an occupied, independent state.
Not a tribe, not an ethnic group, not cultural, an independent state.
He's been working on changing minds ever since, both within Hawaii and around the world. Trying to convince the international community that Hawaii is an occupied sovereign nation might sound crazy, but maybe the craziest thing actually is this. Keanu's is only one of many efforts to reclaim Hawaiian sovereignty. In fact, the state itself even passed legislation establishing a commission to collect the names of Native Hawaiians. The first step in a totally different way of approaching what to do now about this history. Coming up, a whole language that came out of the sugar plantations here and the stigma that still surrounds it. That's ahead on State of the Reunion.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Edson. And now with all this hard history between Native Hawaiians and sugar, you might think that the legacy of plantations in Hawaii is all dark. But some aspects of Hawaiian life that connect back to sugar are celebrated.
That big one there is the Chinese house. I believe this is the Portuguese house. And then the next one over is the Puerto Rican house.
From this cluster of houses in the town of Waipahu, you can see the smokestack of what was once the Oahu Sugar Company. In the 90s, other parts of the world started producing sugar cheaper, and that set off a wave of plantation closures. There's still a little microcosm of plantation life left here, thanks to Hawaii's Plantation Village. This little enclave is a living museum reflecting plantation life. And to Austin Diaz, it feels like home. He grew up on a plantation just like it on Kauai.
Actually, the first house I lived in on the plantation was pretty much looked like these houses. You know, pretty rudimentary, you know, single wall, wooden.
The plantation where Austin lived held a diverse group of people. And that gets at one of the biggest legacies of sugar here. Hawaii's multicultural population. See, in the early days of sugar, there weren't enough Hawaiians to work the fields, so Chinese migrants were brought in. Next, Portuguese migrants came in, then Japanese, and when that group made noises about unionizing, other groups from Puerto Rico, Korea, the Philippines were brought in as a threat to those wanting to organize.
In a plantation town, the Portuguese were in one section of the town, the Japanese were here, the Filipinos were here, and the object was to keep them apart, because they wanted to avoid them getting together, mixing, intermarrying, and then forming a big block of power.
But that only worked so long.
It happened anyway. It was inevitable. You couldn't keep them apart.
Austin himself is proof. He was born to a Portuguese father and a Korean mother, but growing up he was cared for by a Filipino relative. As an adult, he became a Spanish professor and now hangs out mostly with Puerto Ricans. You can't pin one race or culture on him if you tried. And evidence of that ethnic mixing is everywhere in Hawaii. Though it's not uncomplicated. For our next couple of stories, we dive into that. And this next one is from So True producer Tina Antolini. And because it's Tina, you know it has to do with food.
Yep, because one of the best ways to experience the multicultural legacy of the sugar plantations in Hawaii is to eat it.
We have fried chicken, fried fish, fried spam, and teriyaki beef with the sauce drizzled over it, all on top of white short grain rice and takuan. It's radish pickle from Japan, bright yellow, and mayonnaise. I mean, what's not to love?
What Kaui Philpotts is describing is called the Zip Pack. It's a smorgasbord of fried meats and rice at this chain restaurant called Zippy's. It's a quintessentially local kind of place.
Because, I mean, look around you. You know, it's every nationality. It is the perfect combination of food that came from the plantation, things that people love.
Kaui grew up on a sugar plantation on Maui before becoming a newspaper reporter and then food editor at the Honolulu Advertiser. She says the Zip Pack, with its rice and mix of meats from various ethnic traditions, has its roots in the sugar industry.
It goes back to the plantation field workers. It was hard, dirty work, you know, hot, and they got up really early. Anyway, they would eat right there in the fields. And so they would pack lunches.
If you were Filipino, maybe your main dish would be chicken asado. Korean, the sweet and salty ribs called kalbi. I love those. And even though you might have been living surrounded only by your own ethnic group, at lunchtime out in the field, everyone ate together.
It came out of the sharing, because, you know, you'd sit next to a Japanese guy or a Portuguese guy and you go, your lunch looks really good, I want some. And then you take some of theirs and
trade up, I'll give you some of my kalbi for some of your asado.
Yeah.
Eventually, those shared lunch tins evolved into what's become an omnipresent staple of life in Hawaii. The plate lunch.
Well, the classic plate lunch is some kind of protein fried. Then you add to that lots of brown gravy, and that's over two scoops of rice and a scoop of mac salad with lots of mayo. That's the classic.
And even as the plantations closed and people were no longer doing the hard labor that demanded such heavy food, the plate lunch has lived on. You can even find it in the hippest parts of Honolulu.
Yeah, we're at a new restaurant called Highway Inn, which is actually very old, three generations old. They've taken a very old traditional plantation style venue and they've kind of updated it.
Highway Inn is a restaurant that got its start in the plantation town of Waipahu in the 1940s, but it's just opened this new outpost. Food writer Arnold Hura grew up in a Japanese family on a plantation on the Big Island. He says, as the sugar plantations fade into history, the food, the plate lunches, serve as a kind of bridge between the Hawaii of then and the Hawaii of now. And they feed a growing nostalgia about plantation life.
Instead of saying, oh, you know, it was terrible, we were exploited, we had no money, well, most of it probably true. But people say, oh, you know, we missed the old days. Those were good times.
In fact, Arnold says, there are plantation reunions now. People coming back to what once were sugar plantations to gather with others who lived there. Kind of like family reunions.
And everybody shows up. I mean, hundreds of people come. And then they bring food. Some people who haven't seen each other for years and years hug and cry. And it's an amazingly emotional event.
It may seem odd to celebrate a time that held so much pain for the people of Hawaii. But Arnold says, what they're really celebrating is something much more important. The spirit of aloha that they all take pride in.
You know, back when people ate what they had, and shared what they had and made do with what they had and stretched enough so that everybody could be fed. I think that's reflective of some of the more positive values that we treasure, in, not just in Hawaii, but anywhere. Humility, generosity, tolerance. These are big terms, you know, but I think it's reflected in the food. You exercise it every time you eat.
All that mixing, both on the plates and through intermarriage in the population, means it's really hard to tell what someone's ethnic makeup is in Hawaii. But there's a surefire way of knowing who's local. Let's see if you can figure it out. We're back at the Plantation Village now with Austin Diaz, wandering around by the Puerto Rican house.
Hey, how's it?
A jovial guy in work clothes comes up, and Austin introduces him as Larry Toto. Larry was born in Hawaii to Puerto Rican parents and comes here every Friday to volunteer doing upkeep on the grounds. Immediately, Austin and Larry fall into catching up about elderly members of the Puerto Rican community.
You heard Faith pass away,
yeah? And they called me after the thing, pal. Everybody was pissed with Janice. Yeah. Well, you call me when the thing is over.
Now, chatting with Larry a bit, you might have some trouble understanding him.
And then when I pal, if I get time, I help them. I go with the two old ladies and I go clean down there, rake for them. I rake and they pick up the rubbish. Sure, we go about four houses right down the road.
What you just said, when I pow?
When I pow. Yeah.
What does that mean?
What does that mean?
Finish. I pow it. I pow. Now I pick them up, see? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I pow. Pow is finished. Yeah.
Pow is finished in the language Larry is speaking. Yes, it sounds kind of like English and has a lot of English words, but this language is straight out of the sugar plantations. It's formerly known as Hawaiian Creole, but everyone here just calls it pidgin.
It's everywhere. It's constant. It's in families. It's in churches. It's in doctor's offices, it's in white-collar business meetings, it's in construction sites.
Christina Higgins is a linguistics professor at the University of Hawaii Manoa, where she studies pidgin, along with her colleague Ken Sakota, who grew up speaking it himself. Pidgin is kind of like the linguistic version of plate lunch. Remember the waves of migrants from China, Japan, Puerto Rico, Korea, the Philippines? Well, they all spoke different languages originally, so Ken says they had to aim for some common tongue to communicate.
Which would be the language of the masters, the language of the plantation owners, right? So in English here, they would use that language, whatever they can get of that language, right? They're not in a classroom learning the language, so they're out in the fields working, trying to do the job and not get whipped, you know? So they're trying to figure out what the guy's saying there, and this is what they're going to use.
They would combine whatever English they could pick up with words and sentence structures from their own language or from Hawaiian, and slowly, a shared language began to form with a distinct vocabulary and grammar.
And then the thinking was that, you know, pidgin was only good for menial labor on the plantations, you know. So if you want to better yourself, you know, getting these middle class kind of jobs, you know, these white collar kinds of jobs, then you need to leave the pidgin behind and learn the English, you know, learn English better.
Because pidgin was looked at as just bad English, not its own distinct language. In fact, from the 1920s through the 1960s, there was actually a two-tiered school system here, one for kids who spoke standard English and one for pidgin speakers. Christina says it was a crafty way of separating kids based on something other than race.
It was a segregated system, you know, just like all the others in the world. And I think it has the legacy of to the present.
A deep stigma about pidgin came out of that era. Hundreds of thousands of people speak the language in Hawaii, but few will admit it to an outsider. And nearly every pidgin speaker has a story about being discriminated against.
So one of my first jobs, I was a long-distance operator, and the supervisor, I remember telling me that if I didn't speak better English, that they were going to have to let me go. So I had to force myself.
Signe Gottfried knows she's not the only one whose pidgin was holding her back professionally. For years now, she's run a company called Olson Staffing Services that hires hundreds of people.
Actually, many of our clients ask for people who can communicate well, which kind of, if you were to parenthesize that, means doesn't speak pidgin. So some people believe that if you're not capable of speaking proper English, that means you're not capable of handling the job. You're not as intelligent.
For some people in Hawaii, frustration with that reputation has been the fuel for a movement to try and change the perception of pidgin. Back in the 70s, when ethnic studies was catching on with academics, some writers started a publishing house and a literary journal that published writings in Pidgin. In the 1980s, Hawaii's Board of Education tried to mandate standard English in schools, but parents and teachers fought back. A group of university linguists formed a collective called the Pidgin Coop that put out position papers on misconceptions about the language and held workshops about Pidgin grammar. All of that has inspired some younger Hawaiians, folks like
Lee Tonouchi, a.k.a. the Pidgin Gorilla.
What's the Pidgin Gorilla? What does that mean?
Pidgin Gorilla means I'm a hardcore Pidgin talker. I believe in Pidgin rights. I'm a Pidgin writer, Pidgin activist. For some reason, people think I gave myself the nickname out of Pidgin Gorilla. That's kind of lame, bro. You got to give yourself your own nickname, huh?
Lee Tanauchi's nickname goes back to when he was in college. He'd grown up speaking Pidgin, but was taught that it wasn't appropriate in school. Then, in his sophomore year, a professor assigned him a poem by one of the Pidgin advocates from the 1970s, and it was in Pidgin.
So I was blown away, bro. I was like, wow, we're studying Pidgin, and we're studying them in college. Oh, I gotta be smart for studying Pidgin. Yeah, so for me, that was really mind-opening, because, you know, oh, if this guy can do them, maybe I can do them too. So from there, I started, you know, writing some poetry in Pidgin, and eventually I was like, oh, if I can do my creative writing in Pidgin, how come I cannot do my reaction papers in Pidgin? So I started turning in my reaction papers in Pidgin.
Soon, he was doing 30-page research papers in Pidgin. His thesis in Pidgin. He started speaking only in Pidgin, and that is when he got his nickname.
In some ways, it felt like I was breaking new ground, you know, because, like, how come I'm the only one doing this? How come not everybody not doing this, huh? It's just something I felt that I gotta do. Somebody gotta do. If I don't do them, then I don't know if anybody else gonna do them.
Lee went on to become a writer renowned for writing poems and essays in Pidgin. Here's an excerpt of one that he wrote with some of his students about what they've been told they can't do if they speak Pidgin.
They say, if you talk Pidgin, you know, can be smart, be important, be successful, be professional, be one teacher, be one doctor, be a government worker, be the president, be the wife of the president. They say, if you talk Pidgin, you know, can communicate, eat at fine dining restaurant, enter a beauty pageant and win, flirt, function, go out tonight. They say, if you talk Pidgin, you know, can get good grades, get good job, get a smart guy, get a sophisticated guy, get chicks.
Now, you can't expect everyone who speaks Pidgin to be as bold as Lee and pretty much abandon standard English. These days, a lot of people are embracing both languages and using them to fit a given situation.
Sometimes it took on a subversive air. It was almost like a game where we knew to model standard English when the principal would come by and stop into our classroom, but as soon as she left the room, we could break character and get back to being real and sort of working our authentic voices.
Jeff Moniz was a public school teacher in Hawaii for years and grew up speaking both Pidgin and English. He's now a professor at the University of Hawaii School for Secondary Education and teaches his students, who are trained to be teachers themselves, about the power of switching back and forth between languages. In a place that has so many tourists and such a vacation land reputation to outsiders, Pidgin has become sort of a shorthand for saying, hey, I'm from here.
I think people still use Pidgin as a badge of honor or as a way to position themselves in opposition to the dominant system or to mainstream society. So it becomes totally tied to your identity and helps to establish who you are via language.
Or as high school student Matai Alapepe says,
it's like the way to keep the love alive. That's why I think Pidgin is something good for the Hawaiian Islands, is because it shows that we still have that love and passion.
Every place we go with Stay the Reunion, we ask residents to write a letter to their home describing how they feel about it. Daryl Lum is one of the founders of Bamboo Ridge Press, one of the publishing houses that came out of the pro-Pidgin movement. And guess what language he wrote his letter in?
Hey, Honolulu. Nowadays, not like before. Not that before was so hot either. But I think nowadays actually stayed just like before. Nowadays get plenty people working 1, 2, 3 jobs for buy something they think they need. My mother used to tell me, no need, what for? Before time was same. People work hard for buy one house, for go mainland, cause anything from mainland was better. McDonald's, color TV, Coors beer. We wasn't America. America was the Ed Sullivan, really big shoe on Sunday nights after we pow eat. 1 week delay. We was always 1 week behind. We was behind, never going Disneyland, never going see snow. And now, we still chasing the mainland. Broke down Sears for put one Bloomingdale's. They gonna broke down the farmer's market for put up $25 million penthouses. Hey, Honolulu, we still on the plantation. Nowadays, still get plenty Luna. Still get people who shame of who they are. Still get people who telling us who we are. Still get people who only see the dollars. The old timers shake their head and say, nowadays, not like before. They grumble, grumble, grumble and tell, ah, no can help. Progress that. But nowadays, if you know like something, you hold sign and shout, la 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 la, I no can hear you. That's why I still shame. Not about outsiders or insiders. I shame that we no can say, you right and I right and what we going to do. Because in the end, we live on one island. We ain't going nowhere. Nowadays, hard for see where we going. Because no can see the road nighttime. Somebody went, steal a copper wire. See you, Daryl Lum.
Coming up on State of the Reunion, what's happened to all the land that used to be sugar plantations once the industry left Hawaii? Some of it is being used to grow a crop that's caused a huge controversy. Stay tuned.
Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and this whole hour we've been in Hawaii.
Keep your money-hungry development out of our valley. We'll fight you beyond the limit, whatever it takes, because we care.
We're in a rural part of Oahu called Waiholi Valley. It's lush and green and dotted with handmade signs.
Yeah, so this valley is somewhat famous or infamous, depending on your point of view, for fighting development. This is back in the early 70s.
Charlie Rapoon is driving us down a back road in the valley in his pickup truck. He's lived here since then.
So that's kind of a legacy of the sugar companies, because this valley has the stream, Waiholi Stream, has the most water in, as far as volume, of any stream on the island. It was the biggest stream on the island. And that's the reason that the sugar companies were interested in this valley.
They were interested in this valley because sugar is a thirsty plant. It needs 3 or 4 times more water than other crops. But there was a little problem. They wanted to put the plantations on the other side of the island, across mountains that are 2,000 feet tall.
And so then they proceeded to start digging a tunnel. The tunnel was at about 800 feet elevation. They dug this tunnel, and then when they got to the back of this valley, they made a right-hand turn and they went straight through the mountain.
Funneling the water to the other side of the mountain allowed the sugar plantations to flourish.
And so what happened was, is when they finished everything, they basically had diverted probably 3/4 of all the water in the stream.
And this is the story of how a group of farmers helped get it back. Farmers like Charlie and his brother Paul.
I have such beautiful feet. Mud is very good for the complexion. So this cow, you can tell it's ready to pull because it's kind of yellowed. Doesn't look too nice. Real short. So you can see in the middle, there's the one big plant. This is the makua.
Charlie and Paul look like they were chiseled out of the ground. They have the hands of farmers, rough wrinkles and calluses that carry stories and dirt in equal measure. The brothers smile easily and often as they show us the farm where they grow taro. Now, taro is a very starchy root vegetable that once was the foundation of the Hawaiian diet. To understand why the Ripoons and others undertook this battle to get their water back, you have to know a little bit about what water and taro mean to Native Hawaiians.
Their word for water was wai, W-A-I. Their word for wealth was wai-wai. So you can kind of understand what they thought about water. So if you had plenty of water, you had plenty of taro. If you had plenty of taro, you had everything you needed.
There's a Hawaiian legend that the sky and the stars had a child who was deformed and died at birth. From where he was buried, a taro plant sprung up. The next child of the sky and the stars was the first human.
So Hawaiians think of themselves as being the younger brother of taro. Taro is their older brother, so taro takes care of them. It feeds them, and they take care of the taro.
And water is connected to that relationship because the most productive way to grow taro is in a wetland. Hawaiians would direct water from the stream to flow into their taro patches and then back out to rejoin the stream.
So, I mean, that's how we use the water. It's part of the water cycle, but we're just kind of borrowing it and fitting in along the way.
Sugar changed all of that. By diverting the water from the streams, there wasn't enough for wetland taro. Charlie and Paul first got into farming as long-haired hippies in the 70s. They found that the land that should have been good for growing taro was starved for water. Now, this is the era when sugar companies were going out of business in Hawaii. You'd think that that would have freed the water that was diverted back up.
It didn't, because the landowners on the other side of the island, they really wanted to keep this water flowing to that side of the island. They needed to keep agriculture in place. Not because they really wanted agriculture, but because the money that they could make was from development. So they wanted to keep the land in agriculture, keep their taxes low, and ultimately develop the land.
But this was also a time when those anti-development signs were popping up around Waiholi Valley. Ordinary folks were turning into activists. Right around then, the state held a constitutional convention at which ordinary Hawaiians could have input.
Historically, basically, the water didn't belong to any one individual, it belonged to everyone. And the king was supposed to, you know, protect everyone's use of the water. And so the state constitutional convention basically confirmed that.
The water code that passed in the wake of that required anyone currently using water to register for a permit, including sugar and other agricultural companies. And anyone else could object to those permits. So a group of farmers in the Waiholi Valley decided to do something about their missing water.
We had experts from the mainland who knew about streams to convince the water commission, the newly formed water commission, that they needed to restore water to the streams.
The legal battle went on for years and years, but ultimately the farmers won.
Which is the first time that water had been restored to a stream in Hawaii. So this water comes down and it's following the contour basically, and it flows into the tau patches down below.
There are still water rights battles being fought on Maui and Kauai, other places that sugar plantations diverted water. For Paul and Charlie Rapoon, the outcome of those battles is literally the future health of these islands.
Hawaii, as the most isolated group of islands in the world, is really vulnerable to something happening to our supply. So if we don't preserve our streams and dedicate some of our water to keeping it in agriculture, then we're going to be in big trouble.
The island of Kauai is nicknamed the Garden Island for all of its agriculture. That's also made it home to one of the biggest controversies Hawaii has seen in years. So True's Tina Antolini has more.
On the far west side of Kauai, where you once would have seen fields of sugar, you now see a different crop. Corn.
Not even corn for consumption. Testing. Testing. That's what it is. It's a big lab. A big lab with many unanswered questions.
Malia Chun lives in Kekaha, on the west side of Kauai, with her two young daughters. And the corn she's talking about is genetically modified corn that will be sold as seeds on the mainland. The seed industry started research in Hawaii in the 1960s, taking advantage of the year-round growing season and land freed up by the departure of the sugar companies.
You can step right outside my door and...
There you are.
Right there. See? So I'm separated by a little irrigation. Yeah. Yeah.
So the seed companies are your neighbors.
They are, and they're not very nice neighbors, no.
This land Malia lives on, it's Hawaiian homestead land. That's land set aside for Native Hawaiians. Not really a reservation, but that's the closest mainland equivalent. When Malia moved here, the field across the way was uncultivated.
They had stopped growing sugarcane here, so just fallow. I had no idea what kind of plans they had.
A few years later, she noticed the land was being used again. Malia started doing some research about the industry that was moving in to take sugar's place in Hawaii. These were large corporations, Syngenta, Dow, DuPont Pioneer, doing research and testing of genetically modified varieties of corn. Malia found just the idea of that disturbing because of the traditional Hawaiian understanding of the natural world and humans' relationship to it.
You know, for a Hawaiian, food is sacred. And the ritual of gathering food is sacred.
But what worried her more was that this corn required the regular application of a variety of pesticides.
The more I started to learn about it, the more alarmed I got. And the first thing I wanted to do was, like, run out and just tell all my neighbors. You know, like, oh my God, do you know what's happening? You know what's happening around us?
But a lot of her neighbors, who used to work on the sugar plantations, now work for the seed companies. The industry is one of the few major employers on the west side of Kauai, outside of tourism. But her neighbor's employment wasn't resolving Malia's concerns about the spraying in the field next door.
I started to have a hard time breathing. Me and my daughter started to experience really bad allergies. But only certain times, you know. I mean, they don't do it all year round. So once they stop, boom, we got better.
Malia says she was eventually diagnosed with adult asthma. Her older daughter would wake up with bad migraines. She didn't know what was causing these things, but worried it was the pesticides. And she didn't know what they were.
You know, at this point, we have nothing to go on because the information is not disclosed to us. So we're just running on assumptions at this point, you know. So it would be really nice to have some good, solid answers.
That was something that Gary Hooser was hearing about from lots of people when he was campaigning for Kauai County Council. Gary's lived in Hawaii since the 1970s and once served in the state Senate. But he says he'd never encountered a groundswell on any issue like this one.
And it wasn't just my hippie friends from the North Shore, you know, not just the environmental community, but people from all walks of life, all ages were concerned about this industry. You know, I'd give speeches and they'd say, well, how come you didn't talk about pesticides or GMOs?
So when Gary won his election and became a Kauai County Councilor, he decided to do something about it. He got together with another council member and put a bill together, Bill 2491. It required mandatory disclosure of pesticide use by the largest users on Kauai.
And it requires modest buffer zones around schools, hospitals, homes, and stream-sensitive areas. And authorizes the county to do a study, a health and environmental impact study. And that's really what we need to do, to put to rest these fears and problems. Either they're being caused by these chemicals or they're not.
At the time, the seed companies responded by saying that if they made public this information about pesticides, they'd essentially be giving away secrets to their competitors. Plus, they said they were taking every precaution necessary to keep things safe.
We track and trace every single seed that we have here and follow it meticulously.
At Syngenta's headquarters on Kauai, Mark Phillipson leads us around a series of buildings where they're working on trials of seeds that have already gone through the initial steps of being regulated, both by the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There are signs all over the place that say things like regulated GMO work area.
Okay. Wow, even the brooms have regulated on them.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
Well, sometimes, you know, if a kernel will get, you know, I mean, everyone's taught to look at the bottom and the soles of their shoes and check out the brooms. I'm glad you see that. I mean, that's the amount of detail that goes into this.
One small seed in the wrong place could mess up years of tests. And Mark says the company is similarly careful about safety and following the regulatory procedures required by law.
The last thing we want is a hurt employee or to do something that's detrimental to the environment or to anything in the surrounding community where we operate.
But as hearings for Bill 2491 got going, it was clear there were a lot of Kauai residents who were dubious.
I've been dealing with one company from the year 2000. They don't seem to listen.
In comparison to the 18 tons of restricted use pesticides that biotech companies expose us to,
on a yearly basis on our tiny island of Kauai. Make no mistake, this is not the agriculture of our ancestors.
More babies born with missing ear canals, asthma, allergies, rashes, hormonal imbalances, more frequent miscarriages.
We had people literally sleeping on the sidewalks outside the door out here for the opportunity to come in and testify the next day.
Opponents of the bill showed up in force too. The companies bussed in employees to testify about the economic benefits of the industry.
I've been a new employee for only 2 days at Syngenta on Kauai.
Syngenta would not be able to operate. Hundreds would be out of a job. Agriculture on the west side of Kauai would be targeted and destroyed.
I was actually working in the fields during my pregnancy with no concerns for my safety or the safety of my child.
Our children go to those same schools. You know, we are part of the community. And our workers live and work in the fields. They are not reporting these illnesses. I'm not saying that they're not happening, but I'm saying that you might see them there first.
This is Mark Phillipson with Syngenta again. He's also president of the Hawaii Crop Improvement Association, a trade group for the biotech seed industry here.
It gets into an emotional issue, and then it sometimes borders on hysteria. In social media, I've been personally received threats, as a number of employees have. The words "burn their fields down to the ground" are out there and in the public domain. I've been sworn at, spat at, called names that nobody likes to be called.
And here is where the fight over Bill 2491 taps into something much larger than just pesticide use. GMOs are a hot-button issue, not just in Hawaii, but around the world. And the polarization of that debate rides behind everything that's happened here. Here's County Councilor Gary Hooser again.
You know, many believe these companies are evil. And to me, it's not about the health of GMO corn. It's about the impacts on our community.
The debate over Bill 2491 went on for months. The Kauai County Council passed it, then the mayor vetoed it. And then the council overrode his veto. But that doesn't mean this story is over. Several of the seed companies have sued the county to prevent the law from going into effect. In the meantime, they've started participating in what's being called the Good Neighbor Program, in which they notify residents about any pesticide spraying and what is being sprayed. But the program is voluntary. And even now, the controversy has divided Kauai's community in ways that are still being felt.
This is a very, very small island.
Ted Blake is a native Hawaiian who can trace his family back 65 generations here. He says trying to settle this issue in courts and through politics shows an influence of the outside world, an influence he thinks isn't so good for the future of this place.
You know, this is Hawaii. We do have a different way of doing things. There's a way you work it out.
Yeah, what do you think would be the better...
Sit down and talk story. Talk it out.
Ted says Hawaiians don't just think about their present needs. They think generationally. And that gets at what Malia Chun's thinking, too. She wants her children to have more say over the use of land in Hawaii than the generations before who were distanced from that by sugar, and now, she thinks, by seeds.
I have these deep conversations with my daughters, you know. So I have them envision, like I tell them, okay, look out. See all of these fields, okay. What would you do with this? We have to start dreaming and manifesting that in our youth, in our children. How are you gonna use this land?
Hawaii is a place of many layers. The topsoil, what we see, the picturesque paradise. It's easy to buy into. I mean, how could you not fall in love with the oceans, the sunset, the food, the people? It's intoxicating. But just beneath that layer is a story of loss, anger, and resentment, stemming from a legacy of misappropriated resources and oppressed people. But if you dig deeper, you can find the core of these islands, a foundation laid by Native Hawaiians centuries ago. And from that core sprouts a seed that pushes through all the layers and breaks through to the topsoil and blossoms into this wonderful concept